today is May 19th, 1976. This is a continuation, the third side of the interview with Reverend D.W. Johnson. Reverend Johnson, in listening to an earlier conversation that we did, I recall that you made a comment about, a very interesting comment about your mother and the use of the Bible, and it was to the effect that if you misbehaved, your mother would bring you in and she would sit you down and begin to read the Bible to you. Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to ask about that. Did she actually use the Bible as a means of disciplining you as a youngster?
That was her greatest method of disciplining me. And she always showed she loved me. And she was very well versed in the Bible. She had studied it herself, see? Okay, now she would go back and get the Book of Solomon. You know, he wrote 3,000 Proverbs. And there was always one would suit me. I would be suitable for the occasion, you know. Now, let's see what happened. In my early teenagers, she found that I was tinkering around with some illegal woman, you know? And, of course, Solomon, he tells us all about it, you know? And she wouldn't rise up or use her language, but she would read it to me, you know, what would be the consequence and what would be my life, you know? And then everything that she would tell me, it wouldn't be very many days, seem it would come to pass, you know, and even now. So putting it in my mind, and which it is part of me now, greater part, I believe that because she taught it to me, and others did. And those that were able to teach it, you know, as I told you, I showed you where I had gone further then to make it my practical study, you know. And I think it's the greatest book that a man can have in his life is the Bible. You won't go wrong. I believe it. And so since I grew up believing it, it's grow stronger every day, you know?
That's good. Well, she seems to have been a wise person to have made that use of the Bible. I don't know many people who've used it that way, and yet it seems to make a lot of sense.
Well, I tell you what, there was something about her that most people appreciate. And she, as I told you, she's a very devout woman. And she paid attention as she went along, you know. And those things that would help us even now, they're in the family. And we profit by taking her instruction, you know. Now, as I told you, my brother, he's in real estate down in Chicago, the baby brother. She had, let's see, that was Paul, Peter, two of them. They were fortunate enough to get their education, went to college over at Carbondale. And then they got a job teaching, and they taught a couple of years, and they broke down physically, you know. But the next brother to me, he didn't get too much schooling. And he lived until 73, and he died. But the sisters, they got very good schooling, and they started out teaching, but the second sister in the family, she went to work for the welfare along in the late 20s. And down Murfreesboro, she made good. And she fortunate enough to transfer to Springfield. And now she haven't yet retired, I guess, but she got to be the highest paid one in that group there, you know? And she bought a home, raised her family, and then her daughter, she's got a family, and they're now in the early teenage. And my niece is working for the telephone company, and real good paying job. We give it all to Mom. If it hadn't been for her method of teaching us, you know, we'd been like most people, a lot of people, I would say, you know, we just had helped the skeleton, everything can go. But Mom said, sit down, let me tell it to you. And when she tell the story, oh boy, you had something to go on, you know? And she go down to this railroad station where I'm talking about there in Murfreesboro, and the fellow by the name of, I can't think of his name right now, but he was a ticket agent, you know? Lester Fire. Lester Fire was a ticket agent. She went down, got a message from Macon that her dad was seriously ill, you know? We didn't have no money. Mama went down and told the ticket agent, said, Mr. Fire, said, I got to have a ticket. I got to go and see my father. He's sick until death. The doctor said he's gonna die. And, well, he said, I don't know you. She said, well, my son had worked for this road and he's still working for the company. And we've got other friends, and then after all, I don't want you to give me the tickets. My boy's going to pay for it. I was in Kansas at the time, you know. So he'll send me the money, but I haven't got time to wait. So let me have the ticket. He said, well, I can't do that. He said, do you know Pete Ballard? He was one of the horsley helpers in the yards, you know. I said, yeah. So he called Pete, and Pete told him, yes, Miss Johnson will pay. She says she will. He wrote her the ticket. She went to Macon. Then after that, any of the family could go down and tell Lester Fire they wanted a ticket. And just like writing a bank check, you know, he would give it to us. I'd go to Kansas when I got ready, wherever I'm going, you know. So Mama went through life that way, even when she was in Mississippi. And she raised us. That's why we can get things now, you know, because it's a part of us. So I wish it was more mothers like mine, because, and now that didn't mean that she wouldn't chastise us. She read the Bible, but it come necessary, she put me down. She put her knee back of my neck to hold me. Oh my God, she would wear me out. But when I get up, you know, I'm happy, because I don't believe she would hit me a lick, you know, just to be mean. So we got along well. She stayed with us until she was 75, and she left us, but she still lived. And I'm a rich guy now because she learned how to make friends, you know? So that's so much for that. Now, I hope that helped some.
Yeah.
But I was trying to give you the explanation, you know, what you asked. Why did she do that? And that's the results. I got the place that you can come today and feel at home, don't you?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely, that's for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well now.
Right, well that's why I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask about your mother because in listening to the previous tapes we'd done, she seemed very, very important to you, and yet we hadn't really talked about her all that much, so I wanted to give you another opportunity.
Well, she's a jewel to me.
I can see that. I can see why. Yeah. Well, there are a couple of other matters about religion that I wanted to ask, and this may get a little personal, and if you feel it is, feel free just to say so, and you don't have to answer.
Please forgive me if I cut you off.
No.
But there's nothing personal about religion. That's religion is only your belief and what you believe about. See, a religion, we say, is a duty to perform. But it's the method of life in which you live. So you can be anything, can be your religion that you cherish. But then there's a sense of humor, a feeling. It goes with religion, you know, that's above you don't be able to express it, you know. You try, but it's in you, you know. That's your life, and that's your religion, your belief. That's how I get it, you know. Other guys have different explanation, you know. But I say my religion is what I believe. And I be tortured this morning. You can't beat it out of me. No, no, I stay with that. And not easy all the time, because sometimes you're going to run into rocks. Be like that mold. You think the whole world is nothing but rocks and gravel, or you be rooting through them, you know. Now, for an instant, I broke down the other day, didn't I? You regret it, but that's how I felt. Now, there are things in your life when you drive up to that sometimes it's torture. You know, it's for the human side. Now, the human side and the spiritual side, all that religion goes, you know? But when you hit some things, it's just like drinking razor blades or anything, you know, it's torture. Now, for an instant, I hope you'll understand me. Now, this is one. I told you out there on South Beloit, I stayed 14 years and 6 months with one objective, and that was to build a house for the Lord.
This is at the Community Baptist Church.
Community Baptist Church. Okay. And those 14 years with a little congregation, we done very well. We had a little old two-story house when we went there, about big as this room here, you know. So we managed to, they were holding Sunday school downstairs and then maybe one room upstairs, but I went out and we got the, time to time we did a little more and then we added on, put a nice footage there, maybe that was the length of it, you know. And this was the one side that we had. This was the church. Okay, now this is drawn up by one of our best builders in Beloit. And I've got my plans all drawn up. And going to build, God's going to convert this building into here. That would have been the building. That's what I worked on. You know, that's my plan.
Yeah, I should say here that we're looking at a set of the blueprints.
That's right. Set of the blueprints that I had drawn up. Okay. When I come down with New Orleans and Shepherd March, the little guy that had been working the negative side to my positive side. He worked the negative side. And he goes down, tell him at the bank he got everything in his hands now. And he takes another guy's assistant minister, was supposed to have been my assistant minister, and he gets enough people to go down and say, they do away with this and they build what they want. And they tried to get me to sign for it. I told them no. I had my plans. And I had showed him a print of it, you know. And the man brought me this in the hospital. I'm laying flat on my back. I couldn't take it out and do no more, you
know.
What
was the difference in the plans? What changes did they make?
Well, they wanted to tear down this and build one out.
Build an entirely new church rather than build onto the old.
Yeah. So that would have been all right, but all they wanted to do was be sure that my plans was done away with when I had given them my life work for the 14 years. That was all right. The Lord gonna pay me. But I beg the people, don't tinker with that, because the Lord had put it in my mind. He do, you know? And I said, if you do, you're gonna mess up. It's equivalent to the prophet Isaiah. And therefore, you know, when he was the cupbearer of Uzziah, and he had to carry on the work for the Lord, you know. And then Uzziah, he was the great king. And he told them that he would take over, and all the religious work, he'd take it on himself when they had a high priest, you know. So we are told, and we read the Bible, where Isaiah, he begged him not, and there were 70 priests that begged him, don't take this work, you know. But he, being feeling himself, he took over and went and burned the incense and offered the sacrifice in the temple, you know. And when the man did, he brushed out leprosy in his face, you know. And they put him in the pith house. And there he stayed until he died. Then Isaiah wrote the story in the year that King Uzziah died. Well, I told these guys, I said, don't tinker with this. You come in the same category that Uzziah did. But they couldn't hear me, see. And all they want to do is throw you my plans and we be the big shot. I'm not the big shot, I'm just a servant. But if you tinker with this, and I'm begging you not to, you won't come out well. Jerry, before he could get the church built, after he tore the one down that I had, before they could get this one built and on the way, he burst out with a stroke. Paralyzed on one side, took his speech, he can hardly talk now. Before he could overcome that, his wife is down with a heart attack. So I'm not saying that me did it. I'm not saying the Lord done it because of me. But when you see a man out there doing all he can, brother, better be careful how you take it with him if he's working for the Lord, you know? So the fellow that Jerry got, couldn't talk mean enough or go far enough to put the project over. This guy now, he come down week before last with a onion and operated on him, and now he's all jumped up. So the three that thought they was in power, their power have drilled, you know? And so it's very dangerous to fool with religious, if it is practice, you know. So that's that grieved me the day you were here. And you asked me these questions, and you remember me breaking down.
Yeah, I'm glad you explained that.
When I meant to tell you. But when I went out there, I went to the hospital, and I see Jerry, he begging for prayer. Then when I go to see his wife, she lay with a heart attack, you know. Now, all of this was uncalled for. The people ought to behave and not have to come to this, you know. They would have all been well. Now, I'm telling you the truth about it, and I don't care who, I'd argue the best line, man. The people would have been well and healthy, but they took it on themselves to perform duties that were not theirs. And they are not the only one have done such things.
Well, I remember you told us a story about the Bonds family in Mississippi and what happened.
Yeah, well, now I told you about the Bonds family. They didn't live to be old. I told you that. We'll just cut it off a minute. I got it.
Did they eventually get the church built?
These people?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's built. And as I stated, but before they could get it built, Jerry came down. Now his wife is down. They're not either one able. And the third guy, he's physically impaired. So I said the third one, but many of them, you know. But we all should be. Now, I was trying to bring the people, as Moses did, you know, from the land of Canaan, Egypt into the land of Canaan. We all had it going good. I left them with $15,000 in the building treasure. And they had, I think, around $750, they told me, in the mission. Well, now, that I had, just like I bought these places, I buy everything I want, you know. And the banks, they the ministers told me definitely they had my hand, their hand to my back, and whatever I wanted to tell them, and they would see I got it, you know. So that was very good. But these people, they said, well, we're going to do it ourselves. Okay. I wasn't taking nothing to bring up my own, you know, but it was there. I'd be gone one day and leave it all for them, like I leave everything else. But that was their attitude, and so now they're not very happy. That's one point I want to bring out there.
Now, do you believe that illness or sickness is usually or oftentimes punishment for sin?
Well,
just what do you think about that?
Now, I tell you how my conception of it. In things of this kind, the Master tells us in the Bible, I set before you a blessing and a curse. Now, if you accept the blessings, you'll be my word, your goal, and I will sustain all your work. And he said to Joshua, he said, when you get there, every foot of the ground that your foot trod upon will be your course. He makes the promise, you know. But if you be rude, like the Israelites did, and you push my people away and you have your way about it, I leave it to you. And then if it walks up into a bad day, I think you'll do that. His promise, his blessings, his own condition, if we'll obey. If we disobey, and I send you prophet, I send you somebody that will give a life in the work, and then you abuse them, then there'll be a day when the rain comes. And he said, then he will laugh at your calamity. But it don't make me feel good, because I love people. That little old Miss Davis, oh my God, I do hate to see the woman sitting there. Can't do nothing, you know? Hearts won't let her. I just want to see Jerry up on his feet trying to take care of her and take care of his family. I wouldn't do nothing to her. But I did tell him the truth. Don't tinker with it, because I was putting all I had in it. And now you're going to take it and run it and going to tie it up and going to tie it down the building and all of that. It won't be no good outcome. And it hasn't yet. And they're not the only one. I told so many guys that, but I know where to find them when decoration come. They make a hump in the ground. And I could name several people that we've got along like that, you know. I had a guy over at Fairbanks. He just drank too much, you know. I would say justified, say he was alcoholic, but they gave him to me, I had to work with him. Well, either that or he'd be discharged, you know. Guy came out one Saturday morning and he was drunk. One of the other fellows said something to him and he took out on me. And this guy paid, he told him to come and help him to do something that toilet, you know, had to be done. And I said to him, I said, you want to go up there and help him? You want me to go? He and I was down in the pit. Hell no, I ain't going. He began to swear, you know. I said, okay, I'll go. When I got up there and started up on the platform, I had about 4 or 5 steps to go up on the platform. I didn't think the guy was nowhere near him. I looked back and there he was, and the fella had a knife. Oh my God, it was a big knife. I ain't gonna stay down there and work by myself. You had no business to leave. I said, I didn't leave you because I had to. I said, you're the man. I said, one of us had to come and help him. And that guy was motion like that, you know, gonna cut me. Man, I didn't have nothing in my hand that I could offend myself. I backed away from him, or for the length of this house. But another guy happened to see him, you know? And he run to him. He had a big scoop in his hand. He said, if you cut that man, I'll kill you. And the guy turned around, walked about 4 feet to the wall, and he sat down on a bench, sit there, you know? So I said, that's all for me. I won't go no further with you. I said, I didn't do nothing to you, now you want to kill me. I said, one stroke of that knife and I'd have been gone. So Coleman said, go back down there with me. I'll watch him. I said, no, you ain't going to watch me working the knife. No, no, I don't have to. So I was going to tell Whitey to come here. Whitey Babb was the foreman, you know. So Whitey come rushing up. What's wrong? What is wrong? I said, Whitey, I've got a problem I can't solve. And I said, Eli there, you're going to cut me. And I said, one stroke with the knife he had, I wouldn't have been here. I said, I'm not going to work with him down in that hole no more. Come out, Coleman. Did you see him chase Reverend with an open knife? Coleman hadn't stopped him to kill Reverend. That's no. Come here, Arthur Smith. Did you see him chase Reverend with that knife? Sure I did. Paige, did you see him? Yeah. That was 3-1. Said, you come and go with me. Said, we don't work nobody like you. Man, got to work under a knife and threats like that. That's too dangerous. You don't work for us to company no more. Come go to the office with me. Get him to the office, and they discharged him. Next one come over to ask the story, just like you talked to me now, was the superintendent. I had to tell him what happened. The union steward, he come, I had to tell him. And safety man come, I had to tell him the same thing. They sent this fellow home. I had buried his son and his mother. They was overcome with smoke stimulated and fire. I buried them. And then buried his wife. And less than a year, and the stepson and one of the friends come to get me to bury him. And so that's where he went. And I didn't have nothing more to say about it. But I did tell Louis here the other day, it's far better to be the oppressed than to be the oppressor. In life like this, you know. Because you, some guy oppress you, and you can take it. He'll always, you can be happy. And maybe he be the more rootin', you know. But there's so much of that experience that I've had, it puts a lot of fear in me. I have to try to be careful how I treat people, you know. Of course, it's nothing easy to be. When Joe Louis knocked you down, you know the saying, you're down to the count. But if the good Lord knock you down, you do it, you know, through nature, you may be down from now on. There's a whole lot of people that probably would be doing well now, but they messed up along the way, you know? That's my conception of life, and it's been my experience to see it work out so many times, you know?
You said so you believe then that the Lord does work through nature,
yeah,
and that these results
nature
come about.
He leave it, you know, to nature, and then it just comes around like that. Yeah, I know a lot of people that were so big today that the world had to bow to them, but maybe they tinkered with the wrong one, and therefore it. When they begin to reap the seed you sow, it's yours then. You sowed it, you know. So that's where I believe about my religion. And that's one of the beliefs I have, you know, because I saw it come to pass. Now back to the Bones family.
Now, before we leave this, I'd like to ask just a couple of other things.
You're welcome.
While we're on this topic.
Feel free.
When you speak of the master, are you speaking just what do you mean? Are you speaking of God the Father or Jesus Christ, or just what do you mean when you use the term the master?
Well, you see now, God the Father, and we worship more or less through the Son. We get to Him through the Son. You see, all authority has been given to the Son. And that's our belief. And we try to stay in fellowship with Him. If He disqualifies, let me use that word, if He said it isn't right, maybe He put us out of fellowship, but no man can come to the Father except through the Son, you know? Therefore, it pays to try to keep in fellowship with Him by doing His bidding and try to please Him if you can, because if, I still repeat, He too pours out His unpleasant carrying on. If we accept it or we reject it, and when we reject it, it's just as bitter as it is sweet, you know? Yeah. I hope. Was that clear enough?
Yeah, right. That's good. Now, I'm also wondering, you mentioned earlier that you felt it was better in this life to be the oppressed rather than the oppressor. And is that partly because you believe that Jesus is on the side of the oppressor? How do you think, where does Jesus stand in relation to the oppressed versus the oppressor?
Well, now you see the thing about it, He said at one time, it's better that you be in the depths of the sea than to home one of my least ones, because your punishment is going to be just that great, you know. See, no man can swim with a millstone about his neck and to be in the sea. It's enough to be in the sea, but to be with a millstone about your neck. Therefore, you don't have nobody to pray to when he doesn't give it to you. Crystal clear, you know? And then it's just like you walk out there and walk off a cliff because you knew the cliff was there. He give you the seed. And therefore, it's very dangerous to tinker with things that you don't understand, you know, sometimes. So a lot of people do that, and they say, well, I don't understand, and I did it through mistake. But the Bible teaches us, in the days of ignorance, God winked at. But now men are commanded everywhere to confess their sins before God. Now He said, now He would set this law in your heart. And that was to be your understanding, you know? And you can accept or you reject. And therefore, it behooves you to be very careful because you don't get in the nature, don't make no allowance for your ignorance, you know? I think you understand when I said that.
Right.
Yeah. You say, well, now that was nature, that was this, and the cause for that. But it's so close. It's just that how it go, you know. So we personal responsibility. And Mama taught it, and Greta teaches it, and her teaches it. And if we be careful, we'll make it. But other than that, we meet some awful punishment. Now, I haven't been exempted myself. I've come down. Yeah, I've come down. I've hit the rocks more than once. And I would be justified to say some of my shortcoming, I've suffered for it. Yeah, I suffered. But He gave me strength to come back. I'd come back very grateful, with gratitude, and He gave me strength to come on. But I do try to be very careful, not that I contribute anything to my good at all. I don't mean like that. But His guidance and His protection, I made it these many years. Now, even in that mob crowd, and don't be for Him, what would happen to me? I couldn't have come out of that, brother. Those fellows, they wanted to kill somebody that night. And so much for that. We won't have to go back over that. But
we mentioned earlier, though, the Bonds family, and I think you wanted to say something else about them.
Yeah. Well, now you take, they weren't the only family. They was with the family. Now, that made me pay more attention because when they, I told you, they was unfair with me. They was really unfair because I was trying to do something honest. And all I left them for to get $3 more a week. I was getting two from them and $5. I could have that to give my mother, you know, $3 or more. But they was going to kill me because I didn't work for them as a slave, you know. And okay, I went away, and then I went back in the next 20 years about, and they had finished theirs. So far as activities, one was blind, the other was couldn't walk. And William, I think he lasted longer than any of them, but he finally come down with some kind of disease. But Henri, he was a big, stout guy. He folded up in his early life, and so did Charlie. But they didn't do good, and they was among the many others that come down in such condition, you know. We had a lot of people that did mean things, but eventually they wouldn't last too long, you know. And the same thing now. Those that go out for the meanest thing they can do, they have short life. Most of that is suffering, you know. So that's where I found it.
Yeah, all right. Now to shift topics here a little bit. Since we were talking about Macon, you, the last time we talked, mentioned a car on the train that you call the boarding car. And I gathered that this was the car that you traveled on while you were recruiting. And I made a note that when you first mentioned it, to ask you about it again and to describe it more fully. Just what was this boarding car that
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, about the boarding car.
Then. Okay, now the boarding cars, that was where they boarded the gang. Okay, this is a box car, and there was, each end, there was, that would be the bunks, you know, against the wall, and the guy sleep there, you know. Okay. Now then, they had so many of those with the bunks in them. Double, one guy here and one there. You know how bunk beds go. Okay, then we're going out here, we get the dining car. And that would be, the kitchen maybe would be in one end. And then in here, it would be a long table, they called it. And that's how they would feed, you know. And there would be long table in there, and that's how they would feed. And then over here, we did have a water tank on this train, you know. But this would be set out now. For an instant, there would be, we talked about the main line, and then they would switch that over here on the side track. And wherever we were, or wherever the gang was, they call it, that's where they would place this train, the boarding cars.
So you actually lived in these cars there?
Yeah, there was a living. And
when you speak of the dining car here, now that's a car that was only for your use. That was not for other passengers on a train.
No, I rode the main train. The main train, passenger train. That's where I would haul the people on. Yeah, we rode right with the older passengers.
So the dining car then was used by all of the passengers.
But no, this was not on the passenger train. This was just the place, these trains, these cars, boarding cars. That was, I see they had so many, and Jim and Noah had so many.
So when you were doing line work then,
yeah,
you lived on these boarding cars.
Mainest work, for an instant, that would be needed in Jackson. They'd take the whole maybe as many men as they had, 25 or 30 men, to be on these cars. And that was the boarding car. This boarding cars now would be just like a motel or dormitories, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Right, that's clear. Yeah. Now, but when you recruited, if I understand it right, just to make sure, then you used regular passenger cars.
Yeah. See, there was just, they never had to have an extra train. Now, they would make up a train, they call it a work train. And then they would have extra car, you know, coach for that. They'd have a coach for passengers for you to ride in. And then in this Inwell City kitchen, maybe they would have the tools. They had tools, you know, maintenance tools. And then when you get there, wherever you're going, you get off, you get your tools out of this car, and then the passenger car, it remained the same. And they would run those kind of trains. But when I was recruiting, I rode the regular passenger train. And then I could go any time, day or night. It was pretty nice, you know. I got joy out of it. You made contact with so many people riding, you know. And then I would go all the way into Mobile. Sometimes it was very nice. You get talking with a person, you know, maybe a woman. And she, well, you know about her family. You tell her what your job was, you know, and then maybe she could help you to tell you why you pick up a fella, you know, too. And some of her acquaintance, you know, and then I go there. But I still say, never me. It was always the other fella, see, because I knew what I would run into if I would let it be known it was me. So that was one great thing I appreciate until today. Maybe I wouldn't have been alive. Okay, now, is that clear?
Yeah, right, that is. I just wanted to ask because I wasn't quite clear on that point. And
When I said the boarding car, that's how they boarded these railroad men that I brought in, you see. When they get there, and they would go to either one of these cars, and, you know, and they would be given the rights, just like you give your room, you know. And then they all would come to the one dining room to each, you know.
Were these boarding cars segregated?
Well, I tell you what would happen, and there wasn't hardly ever over two or three white guys on them, and more or less they stayed in one car. And the boss, the assistant foreman, and the flagman, and therefore they more or less would be in one car. Of half of a car, it would be made up like an office, you know, and they would have bunk beds in there. They would sleep. And then sometime they, if they were in some towns, they would stay out in hotels, you know, and have other lodging, but they'd have to be in line and keep in touch with the station. If you know what I mean by that, if anything happened in this area, in this territory, you know, they had to be in a position to know it. So for instance, it could be a wreck, a counter track, anything happened. They had to be where they could be notified. But more or less, they would stay a week at a time, and they would stay on these cars. That would be three, and then after I learned to flag many times. I would do the flagging. And so that was the situation, though.
I see. That's very good. You seem to have a love almost for trains. Is that accurate? Did you have a special feeling for trains? Was this some people today feel about jets, the big jet planes that they're so beautiful and everything. Did you have any of that feeling about trains?
Well, I tell you what. In my early life, I read Norman Vincent Peale's book, Power Party Thinking. And that's one thing that I remembered. He said, whatever you do, just radiate with it, you know? Let it become a part of you. And it's just to get all in you, you know? Okay, now when I was on those trains, oh, was no far from fear, a fear from anything, you know? I just felt like a feel now. And then when I go make contact with a guy, I know I'm playing the safe side because I haven't told him who's going to pick him up, you know? And that was all right. I got along there. And I remember one time, as I said, I learned to do the flagging, the braking, and everything. There was one engineer. We went out on a work train. And when they said the work train, that was whatever the situation may be. Now, we were hauling dirt. They had a steam shovel loading cars, and those cars, they trip by a level, you know, and they would dump them. And the gang, they would be breading it and whatever the situation would be. But I rode the train. I was with them, you know, and they're dumping these cars. Well, in that, I learned all the signals, you know, and backing up and whatnot, you know. This engineer, he would accept it. And his name was Bob Westover. And he's out of Murfreesboro. And we're working out of Murfreesboro now, see. And when the next week, they sent another brakeman. Now, this devilish brakeman, what one that I could do all the work, he sat up in the cab with the engineer and the fireman, you know, let me do the work. But I was glad to do it because I was getting all the ones in it, you know. So when I got the car about loaded and I'm ready to go to the dump where we're going to dump it, you know, I give Westover the signal to get out, you know. Oh, hell, he won't pay you no attention. I say, you won't? And by that time, he had his throttle in his hand moving, you know. But this guy thought because I wasn't a brakeman, he wouldn't accept my signal, you know. But he learned different that I did all parts of it. Even when going into, now they had this train out and we carried this locomotive in every week. I had to go into Murfreesboro. We up out spotted now about 35 miles. And every week we had to take this locomotive in to get it washed, you know, and they do it, clean it up so we come back Monday. Well, I would do most of the firing going in. I had to fire then with the coal shovel, you know. And I did most of the firing going to and fro because I wanted to learn to fire. And that's a lot of things you've done. It wasn't your job, but the other fellow let you do it, and therefore you took advantage.
Well, now, did it ever bother you that you couldn't have the job of fireman or engineer or conductor, even though you could do those jobs? But I gather they weren't open to you. Did that?
No, you know the thing that they would tell you whenever you applied for them, the union wouldn't accept you. That was the alibi, you know, the union wouldn't accept. Okay, now you take all the way from Mobile, the black farmers could come into Tams, Illinois, and they had to tie up there and get the next train or get the route train that they were supposed to go back on. The local union wouldn't let them come no further. And they had some of the best firemen on that end because I don't know if the road was heavier, but they brought those trains over when the white farmers couldn't, you know, firemen. You know, that's quite a little art to put that coal in there so it'll burn, you know, and keep the heat. Now, when I first started shoveling coal, we get to a hill. If you don't know exactly how to fire, it pulls all your steam down, you know. And a certain way you had to place your coal in the box, in the fire box, you know, and you had to know something about it, you know. I wanted to learn that, because one day I didn't know what would happen, you know. But I learned all I could about the railroad, and then I told you about the tracks, you know. And after so long, they'd tell me to take a bunch of men. I'd go out there and do the work just like the rest of them, you know, and be very fortunate to get along with the men. So in the times that I learned quite a bit about it. And then I would do a lot of times now, for instance, in the summer months, the spring, construction work. I did quite a bit of that because they paid twice as much as the railroads, you know. A lot of time I'd work all the summer and fall on construction job, and then as soon as ever get too cold or too rainy, I go back to the railroad. They'd be glad to see me when I get there, you know. And so even if I was to go to some of those jobs now, they'd be very appreciative to have the old man back, because I took the work off of them, and we got along, you know.
That's good. Now, I want to go back just a little bit to the time when you were in, the first time you were in Beloit at Fairbanks Morris, and ask about a man who was supposed to have been a recruiter for Fairbanks Morris in the South. And I was wondering if you were acquainted with him. His name is Walter Ingram. Did you know him, and what could you tell us about him?
Well, I got acquainted with Walter later. But the one that I understood that brought us out of Mathisburg, I didn't see him, but I was told he was J.D. Stevenson. You heard of him, Ed? Yeah. Now, when we got to the station that morning, I tell you, there was a local minister in our bunch. His name was Reverend, it wasn't Pride. But anyway, he had the tickets that we got. And he gave them out at the station. There was 20 of us left that night at Mathisburg coming into Beloit to Fairbanks, you know. And I didn't see this agent recruiter, you know, whoever he was, whether it was Ingham or whether I was told after I got here it was J.D. And then we walked from the station here out to the flats, and then J.D. Stevenson, he'd taken us over to Fairbanks to be signed in. Then later I got acquainted with Ingham.
Did you know Walter Ingram when he was recruiting for Fairbanks Morris? Did you ever talk with him about that?
No, I didn't have any conversation pertaining to that. Later I was told that he recruited, he brought in men, and then I think Holloway, he's over there now. He went out, Lennon Holloway. And there were several of them, and some run into some, I think Holloway, they run into problems one time, and they have told me about it through the years, you know. Sometime we begin to talk about the experience we had recruiting, you know, recruiting.
What was Mr. Holloway's first name?
Lennon, yeah. He's foreman, general foreman, I think.
Okay. Now, well, when you did get together with these men and discuss the times that you'd had going down to bring back men, what did you talk about? How did those conversations? What do you recall of those conversations?
Well, it was just being general. We would talk about the different towns, you know, and conditions of things, you know. And it was just as much interesting now as it was then, you know, because you think about now the fellows that many of them I brought out, they had families, you know, and they really needed better jobs, make more money. And there were some just out of school, and they come along and maybe they would stay on the gang a while. Some stayed longer than others, you know. And then they would get into St. Louis and Detroit and did real well. So I still feel good that I was able to help them along the way, you know. Yeah, I brought some, and they get off the train. The conductor goes more or less see that you got off if I got you marked up on this pass, you know. They would walk to the next stop and buy them a ticket and go on nowhere else, you know. That had happened to me, too. But after all, I had done my job. I couldn't make them stay, you know. It didn't happen too often, but occasionally it did.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting part of the story. You mentioned also once the last time we talked that you were rolled in a tornado, and I didn't get a chance to follow that up.
Tell you about that.
I was wondering what that experience was all about.
Okay, now here we go. I was working out in the shop, to buy the shop, maintain the shop, you know, the big shop, railroad. And we were...
Now, this was where?
At Maithapur. And that was the blacksmith. He was in the apartment. And we had an occasion to be out on the yard, the big clamshell, loading some structural steel. And there was... Time had come, the wind pretty well blew one fellow off the car. He's standing on the side of a coal car, you know, just about blew him off. And he managed to get to the ground without being blown off. And then we all run into this shop. Now, it was a few tracks over. They had to call the, it was a carpenter gang. And they were all white. And they was floating gang, they called them. They went everywhere on this division. Whatever he says it was to build, you know, they built it. And there they were building some lumber sheds. And there was, I think, about 20 of them or more in this gang. They run into this blacksmith shop, and all the laborers run in. And one fella named Bob, family name, but anyway, he said, get under the shop, man. Get under the shop. Said, tornado coming over there, and it's going to blow this shop away. And that sounded exciting, you know. Oh, it looked as far as it could, and looked like a muddy water was just rolling. This looked like you can picture muddy water rolling. And brother, and you'd hear the house, you hear that little house cry, and that was about all of it. Now, I was traveling the clock at all, so I'm pulling everything back, you know. And brother... When the lights begin to fly out, that big windows, you know, and they're hitting you in the face, busting in your face and all like that. And they're saying, we run to the door, and all these guys stampede in a small door, you know. I don't know how many men were. It must have been 40 men. But, oh, brother, that was awful. And we all stampede. Now, nobody can get through because of the wedge. So I looked over the guy's shoulder. And Bob said, hold the wall, man, hold the wall, so you might can keep it off of us. And about that time, I jumped against the door case, there you know. And I put all I had on. There was others, too, you know. And when that sharp emotion about three times, and he had come down on us. And I checked my head over, and it hit my ear, and it knocked. Used to be a seam there where it knocked it about half down, you know. And, brother, then I fell, and that house... Heavyweight, you know, it fell pinned. Half of me was pinned, just like that by the door case, you know. Brother, you talking about something? I tore off hide, the overall suit I had on. I tore it about off, man. Boys, I could get was on my all fours, and I lent me to that table. Something knocked me down. Oh, brother, that was a beating. My God, that was tough. And, you know, that wind, I don't know, somebody said it lasted 30 minutes. If it lasted over 3 minutes, I don't know who could have stood it. Because that was everything coming, you know. And I piled up one big piece of timber, it fell, and I was kicking around there somehow. It fell right across my hips. If it had a fell on my back, I would have been broke before it was then. But I didn't have to pin me to the ground, you know. And I'm venture to say I must have been wrapped up in ruggage 3 or 4 feet deep. And was, everything was on me, you know, from tar paper to heavy timber. And must have been a 2x4. Something hit me in the hip and this bust that wide open. And down near my knee, some thick part of my hip, laid it open. And oh, brother, bleeding everywhere. And then immediately when that wind passed over in the rain, there come a hard hail. And oh boy, it beaten me to death. And I couldn't get up, just tied there. Hassling like a chicken hen. And it was all for me, I'm gonna be gone now. And as I said, it must have lasted 3 or 4 minutes when I could And this arm here, it was all paralyzed and hit so hard, you know. Not much use of that. I took one hand, I dug out. Got on my feet and I looked. First direction I looked was towards home where I lived, you know. Forward I could see everything was rolled. The boxcars, locomotives, you know, the turntable where they turned them in a pit like, you know. There was one stood there, the biggest in the world, and the coal tender of it, that's the part that carried the cold water, you know. It was tipped over in the pit. And that big locomotive was just a boiler part and the engine was stood there with a solemn hum. Oh my God, that's, couldn't see a soul nowhere. Then I stood upright, still bleeding. Thought, well now, I've been given the whole world by myself. Not a human left, nobody to talk to. Brother, I got lonesome. And the next guy dug out was my foreman, his name was Walter Cox. He was blacker than I was. Soot and everything blowed in his face, you know, and his hair down in his face. He got up and he yelled, wow! I said, Walter, I got a cripple over time. What are you hollering so loud? He said, both of my legs broke, both of my legs broke, he said. And brother, we didn't see nobody for quite a little while. And then we started out. First Street was Poplar going north out of the yard, you know. So we got down there and this fella Steele, he was the foreman of the car builders, you know, they built the cars there on the yard. And he was the foreman of that bunch. You know, a large gang, he had a carpenter to build. And he had a house on the reservation, you know, a two-story house. Now his wife was standing on top of that house, just like that. And it seemed like her head was cut in a circle, and she was blood just standing there. She just stood there, you know? Well, was nothing I could do, bleeding myself, thinking I was gonna pass going, you know? We hobbled on, got to 17th Street, and there was a man, got that one, pulling a woman out from the house. She had a dead child in her arm. The child was killed. And the woman, too. But she still held this child. The man drug him out. Her name was Mrs. Jackson, and I think it was a niece of hers. But anyway, about 2-3 doors, a white fella said, come help me, come help me. Get my wife out from under this house. My wife's going to be burned up. I said, I'm sorry, but ain't nothing I can do. If I stop, I feel like I'm going to be past going myself, you know. I kept hobbling on. And that was on 17th Street, and everything was laid low, you know. Many poison yelling under the house. It was in March, and so many of them had fire, you know. In fact, everybody had fire in their frame houses, and they go down, their fire just come on up, you know, and burn up the bodies. Brother, that was a local church band. So I got to 14th Street and I met a guy coming. I says, the storm is bad back this way where you come, is it is where you see where you're going? Just as far as you go, he said. It's the same thing. And then I knew where my people lived. It was all frame buildings and past all the brick and the stucco and all kind of structures laid low, you know. But when I got down there, there was only two men was killed on 3rd Street, and that was a light plant. And they busted their boilers, and two men were burned to death there. But in all total, there were 300 people killed outright, and many of us were wounded, and many for life.
You mean in that one community, just in Murfreesboro, there were 300 people killed?
300 in Murfreesboro. Now, this didn't only stop in Murfreesboro. It went to Dower, and that was about 6-8 miles north, you know. He'd sit down, he'd do corn, and I don't know how many of those towns he did it. But it, where he over here plowed through, it was just like a man on a meadow plowing. He just plowed everything down.
Do you recall what year that was, or do you recall how old
you were? I will. That was 1925, on March 18th. I couldn't forget that. God, oh, brother, that was a miserable day. Now,
how did you eventually survive? How did you eventually get your injuries taken care of?
Well, I tell you what, when I got home, I guess there wasn't a place. I eventually say on my skip that there wasn't a cinder blowed into. But my wife and another friend girl she had, they washed me up, and picked them all out, dressed my wounds, and I didn't go to hospital till the next day. Because they was picking them up, you know, all that were wounded, alive, and the hospital was full. They sent a trainload of nurses and doctors out of Chicago, and they set up all the hospital, you know, temporarily, emergency. They set them up in the churches. And I pretty well blew, I think, the undertaker parlors, one or two of those were blown away. And then they give them the church basement to pull all these dead bodies in, you know. And I went the next day to see them. Now, how they done them? They stripped them off nude. They put a Kotec on the women like that, you know. And that's all the covering they had. And they left the body visible, so you had a scar, incision, anywhere you might identify, because you're just all but like scarling human that try to identify them with all that stuff on them, you know. And then everybody was same color, as black as they could be, because that's such, you know. And people would go in there and they would, through these marges and church basements, and they identify a body, and it was pitiful. They had a tag on the arm to write it, you know. And some of them didn't have any arms. We had several bodies that were burnt, the head off and the arms and legs off, and just the bulk of the body. And then some were found at all.
I feel lucky that you're here today, and I'm glad you are.
And in the same shop where I dug out and got out, there was unnumbered amount of pillars. Just for an instant, they'd be working on machine, you know. And they go back there and they find his watch or ring where his body burned, you know. Because his fire, it went over, you know.
That's incredible. Well, we're about out of tape again here.
Okay.